Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
Russia and Belarus kick off massive military exercises that experts caution could serve as cover for a Ukraine attack. Plus, pharma earnings shed light on the business of COVID-19 vaccines and treatments. And Israel changes tack to stem growing Hamas support in the West Bank.
By building up the Palestinian Authority, that undercuts some of that support for Hamas and probably puts things on a track that Israel's a little bit more comfortable with.
It's Thursday, February 10th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Russia kicks off massive military exercises in neighboring Belarus today, opening a new front for a possible invasion of Ukraine from the north. Some 30,000 troops are expected to be involved in the drills. It comes amid a buildup of Russian troops on Ukraine's border that NATO has described as the largest since the Cold War. Journal Moscow correspondent Evan Gershkovich says security experts are concerned about Russia's intentions.
They also point out that the drills are peculiar given they're coming in the winter during harsh conditions. Some experts worry that the deployment could be serving as a cover for Russia to launch a multi-directional attack on Ukraine. Experts are also considering the possibility that the troops could remain after the drills are meant to end on February 20th and be stationed as a buffer against NATO countries in the event of an invasion on Ukraine.
In response, Ukraine is also beginning military drills today, with soldiers training with Turkish armed drones, as well as anti-tank weapons recently supplied by the U.S. and the U.K. California regulators have sued Tesla for alleged racial discrimination and harassment at its principal car plant in Fremont, California. The head of California's Department of Fair Employment and Housing cited hundreds of complaints from workers at the plant. He also cited evidence the factory is, quote, a racially segregated workplace. Tesla didn't immediately respond to a request for comment, but did criticize the investigation in a blog post that preempted the lawsuit. The company has said it strongly opposes all forms of discrimination and harassment. Federal judges and members of Congress could soon face new restrictions and disclosure requirements on their stock trades. Democrats are nearing consensus on legislation that could ban lawmakers from trading individual stocks or require them to place stock portfolios into a blind trust. The proposals also call for new rules for federal judges. Last year, a Wall Street Journal investigation found that more than 100 federal judges broke the law by hearing lawsuits involving companies in which they also own stock. And Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi faces a key test as state elections kick off today. At stake is the support of voters in India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh, which could determine his government's staying power. Our South Asia correspondent Sean Lee says the world's third largest economy has been hard hit by the pandemic and rising inflation.
So there's a lot of frustration among people in the state and around the country about rising food and fuel costs. And Prime Minister Narendra Modi actually had to come out and defend his government's handling of inflation this week. And that frustration could spill over into the ballot box.
And without popular support, Modi could struggle to implement economic reforms he says are needed to improve overall welfare in the country. Last year, Modi abandoned an overhaul of the farming industry in the face of mass protests. It's a big week for makers of some of the world's leading COVID-19 vaccines and therapeutics, with Pfizer, GSK, and AstraZeneca all announcing earnings. Here to help us discuss the business of playing a leading role in the pandemic response is the journal's Denise Rowland. She covers the pharma industry from our London bureau. Hi, Denise.
Hi.
All right, let's talk about GSK and AstraZeneca. How has the pandemic impacted their earnings?
Yeah, so AstraZeneca posted record annual sales this year. A big part of that was their COVID-19 vaccine, which made $4 billion for them this year. For AstraZeneca, a lot of that top line came from its vaccine, but very little of the bottom line because it has mostly sold it for not-for-profit. GSK was also strongly impacted by its antibody therapy, which is a treatment for COVID-19 rather than a vaccine, that contributed about $1 billion in sales this year.
As you mentioned, AstraZeneca had somewhat of a disappointing forecast for its vaccine revenues. What is driving that, and is that in any way unique to them?
Yeah, so the AstraZeneca vaccine played an important role early on in the pandemic. You know, it was bought up by governments as they were preparing to vaccinate their populations. But it has fallen out of favour somewhat, especially in high-income countries. There were some concerns about very rare but a potentially dangerous blood clotting from that vaccine. And that sort of shifted the emphasis in those countries to other vaccines. And for their booster campaigns, they're mostly using the so-called mRNA vaccines, which are the ones made by Pfizer and Moderna. So for AstraZeneca, it continues to be an important vaccine for low and middle income countries, but it's not really selling into high income countries anymore.
By contrast, as you mentioned, Pfizer's mRNA vaccine remains in quite high favor in higher income countries. How has that affected Pfizer's bottom line?
So, well, Pfizer doesn't break out what's contributing to its profit, but its profit doubled last year. And I think a lot of that is down to the vaccine. Pfizer does sell the vaccine for a profit, and Pfizer says that the vaccine was the biggest selling pharmaceutical product of any sort anywhere in the world last year. So it was a big boost for Pfizer. They made nearly $37 billion in revenue from that vaccine last year.
Denise, we've increasingly heard about how COVID-19 is gradually transitioning into becoming an endemic disease, one that could require periodic booster shots, perhaps for years. What does that mean for pharmaceutical companies over the long run?
Yeah, I mean, the word that comes up again and again in pharma earnings about COVID-19 is uncertainty. The CEOs see it as a bit exceptional. They know that this has been an exceptional 2 years. And they can't quite predict how it's going to play out. So the Pfizer CEO earlier this week said they do expect income from its vaccine to decline over the years. But whether, you know, it becomes a semi-annual booster, an annual booster, whether other new vaccines come and compete more strongly with Pfizer's, it's all a little bit to play for. You know, COVID-19 isn't going to be eradicated. It will become endemic. It will become something perhaps like flu, which is with us all the time and that we, you know, do treat. So I think they all expect their COVID-19 products to play some sort of role in the future. I think no one is quite bold enough to predict yet how big of a role and whether those will be really big contributors to revenue and profit in the long run.
That was the Journal's Denise Rowland. Denise, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Luke.
Coming up, Israeli policy toward the Palestinian Authority is shifting from one of isolation to offering a range of economic support. We'll hear from our correspondent in Israel after the break.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Israel is changing its policy toward the Palestinian Authority. Nearly 8 months after replacing longtime leader Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is now pursuing a range of economic measures that represent a big break from his predecessor. Joining us from Israel with a look at what's changing and what's likely to stay the same is the Journal's correspondent for Israel and the Palestinian territories, Thomas Grove. Hi, Thomas.
Hi there.
Thomas, in order to help us understand whatever changes have occurred in Israeli policy here, could you compare how the Israeli government dealt with the Palestinian Authority previously under Prime Minister Netanyahu with how they're approaching them now?
Comparing what's happening now with what happened under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, I think it's important to consider the fact that high-level dialogue basically stopped under him. And what we're seeing now, that's a big kind of conceptual shift, both for the government and for Israelis as well. But apart from that, we're seeing, you know, some very small measures being taken to kind of ease some people's lives in the West Bank. There's loans that are being offered to the Palestinian Authority for money that Israel deducts from what it gives the Palestinian Authority in terms of its tax revenues. We're seeing also some ID, Israeli-approved IDs being handed out to people in the West Bank. And that's important just in terms of being able to move around the region with military checkpoints and security checks kind of pretty pervasive throughout that region. This is a really important thing for people to have. They really can't travel very far from their houses at all without them. So it's a big deal.
All right. So what is the Israeli government's rationale for shifting its policy towards the Palestinian Authority?
There's real strategic considerations at play here for the Israeli government whenever they're looking at these measures and taking these measures. And I think they're twofold. One is to try to reduce tensions a little bit. There's been an uptick in violence in the last several months. And I think one thing that they're hoping it may do is reduce that. But on a broader level, you have a rise in popularity of Hamas, which rules the Gaza Strip and is becoming increasingly popular in the West Bank since the conflict of May last year. And so I think by building up the Palestinian Authority, giving them some legitimacy in terms of making lives better for the Palestinians in the West Bank, that undercuts some of that support for Hamas and probably puts things on a track that Israel's a little bit more comfortable with in terms of where those two powers stand.
Okay, and how is that economic help from the Israelis being perceived by Palestinians?
I think everybody's very realistic about the extent to which those measures will change the way Palestinians perceive their own government, the way that they perceive Israel. Obviously, we've seen a certain rise in the approval ratings of the Palestinian Authority, and that certainly some pollsters believe that that is an indication that, that's starting to work. They're seeing Palestinian Authority as a state-building kind of enterprise and as maybe a more legitimate body than it was a few months ago. But there's still also a sense that, you know, these are piecemeal initiatives. This isn't tied to any political resolution. And so therefore, it's a way of helping them survive, but it's not really giving them everything that they want.
Got it. I mean, it sounds like these changes may have more to do with shifting sentiment in the West Bank than necessarily with who's running Israel. So take us to the West Bank. That's where you've done a lot of your recent reporting. What is driving Hamas's recent surge in popularity there?
Ultimately, I don't think the rise in support for Hamas it's not a foregone conclusion, so to speak, coming off of a war in which many Palestinians saw Hamas as successful because they saw Hamas firing rockets into the Israeli heartland. And basically, they saw Hamas keeping its promise in terms of deadlines as to when it was going to fire, when it was going to start hostilities. And so for a region like the West Bank, seeing a governmental authority, whether you consider them legitimate or not, is a real game changer. They've seen the Palestinian Authority kind of fail on many promises that they tried to give in terms of elections, in terms of services. And so there's a real sense of disappointment with the Palestinian Authority as a governing body. And to see Hamas take control and follow through with what they said they were going to do really just gave them a lot of legitimacy in the eyes of average Palestinians.
And all of this begs the question, where does this leave the Israeli-Palestinian peace process? Talks haven't occurred in years, but has there been any movement there perhaps lately?
That seems to be off the table. I think when we're looking at the Israeli domestic politics that put this coalition together, it's drawing from a very wide spectrum of political interests. And I think to kind of keep that coalition stable, they're trying to shy away from any dramatic moves that kind of break the status quo. And so, you know, Naftali Bennett himself has said that this is not tied to a peace process. And so that is off the table for the time being. I think the U.S. has voiced hopes that these measures ultimately could lead in that direction. But for now, we have to basically wait and see.
Thomas Grove is the Journal's correspondent for Israel and the Palestinian territories. Thomas, thanks so much for the time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Lou.
And finally, from brain implants that restore our sense of smell to VR headsets that make up for failing eyesight, or even a spoon that tricks us into tasting salt, a flurry of new inventions aim to find technological workarounds to the challenges of old age. Journal contributor Benoit Morin has been looking at these gadgets at the intersection of the wacky and increasingly viable science.
We're seeing a convergence between consumer electronics and medical-grade devices, and that should be even more pronounced in the future. One example is the hearing aid, which used to be this obtrusive device that was also socially stigmatized. Now it's completely invisible. You could be wearing one, I wouldn't see it. And those hearing aids pack in AI technology to fulfill what they were designed for, which is to make sound around us crystal clear, amp up speech, reduce noises, but they could also be integrated with things like smart glasses and whisper in your ear the name of the person sitting next to you at this business meeting. And that is an interesting aspect that I expect we're going to be seeing more broadly.
And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.